When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so you don't miss a single episode. They come out each Monday and always feature big-name rock stars that found fame in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. Now, today's episode is another My Five Favorites, and I hope you enjoy these as much as I do. I find them fascinating as it gives us a window into these rock stars' world. We all have our own favorite songs and albums from certain artists, but these interviews lifts the lid on how they feel about their own music, and it gives us an insight into the background, the making of, the stories around them, and all that sort of stuff, which makes it really unique. Now, my guest is a man who you will 100% have heard his playing on, because he's played on more than 2,000 albums, which is insane. He's a bass-playing superstar with an image to match. His huge white beard makes him instantly recognizable. If you go on Wikipedia, his discography has a page of its own. So, in alphabetical order, here's just some of the people he's played on records for. Air Supply, America, Laura Branigan, Jackson Browne, Cher, Joe Cocker, Leonard Cohen, Phil Collins, Alice Cooper, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Spencer Davis, The Doors, Doro, Sheena Easton, Don Felder, Peter Frampton, Peter Gabriel, Art Garfunkel, Hall & Oates, Don Henley, Waylon Jennings, Carole King, Nils Lofgren, Steve Lukather, Giorgio Moroder, Willie Nelson, Mike Oldfield, Dolly Parton, Bonnie Raitt, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, Sting, James Taylor, Toto, Brian Wilson, Warren Zevon, and so many more that I don't have time to mention. He's also played on loads of film and TV soundtracks, including the iconic TV theme to The A-Team. I am, of course, talking about the wonderful Leland Sklar. Now, Leland, as well as being one of the greatest session musicians and touring musicians of our time, has also teamed up with a group of fellow session legends who've been playing together as friends for 50 years now. They've called themselves The Immediate Family, and I highly recommend you check out their new album, Skin in the Game, and the brilliant documentary that was released last year all about them. It's called The Immediate Family. Fascinating stuff as well. I think it's won awards at like 19 different film festivals or something, so it's highly, highly recommended. But for today, we're going to focus on Leland's incredible back catalogue and asking him to choose his five favourite albums that he's played on, which, as I said, with more than 2,000 to his name, makes this a very difficult task indeed. There's some great stories in here that I know you're just going to love. So please enjoy this chat with Leland Sklar. Give us your first choice then, Leland.
Well, one of the ones that really still gets attention, and a lot of people come up to me and they go, I didn't know you played on that, was Billy Cobham's Spectrum. We cut that in 1973 at Electric Lady Studios in New York. And our group, The Section, had been on the road opening for Mahavishnu Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And and for those that don't know, they were one of the forefront of the jazz rock fusion era of the early 70s with Chick Corea and Return to Forever and Herbie Hancock and Headhunters and all that. And we went in the studio to cut that album. We had finished the tour with them, and Billy and I became friends, and he contacted me and he said, look, I got a record deal. Would you come to New York and work with me? And I said, I'd love to, because we went in, we cut the album in 2 days.
Oh, wow.
It's really one take of each song. And I had become friends with Billy and Jan Hammer, the keyboard player in Mahavishnu Orchestra, and they were going to do it. But when I walked in the studio, Tommy Bolin was there to play guitar. Now, I knew Tommy from Zephyr days back in the late 60s when I was in a band called Wolfgang, and we did gigs together. In my heart of hearts, Tommy was still probably one of the greatest guitar players that's ever lived in the rock and roll business. So we got in there and we had a ball, but it was a ferocious couple of days. I almost couldn't remember it when I left because it was so intense. But any time I'm anywhere in the world, if I start playing do 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 do, man, guys jump all over it. So that was really for me one of those albums that, first off, nobody ever really thought of me in that genre. Yep. So it's really fun that they discover that. And plus, I loved the guys. It was an amazing project.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's different to some of the other ones we've got on this list that's still to come. And the complexity of the songs and the fact that you did them in one take and maybe two takes at the most, and you did it over just 2 days. I mean, how did that work then? Do you go into the studio having worked out what it was going to be in advance, and then you just say, let's record it and see what happens? Or how does that kind of thing work?
I hadn't heard one thing before we got in the studio.
Okay, wow.
I had no idea what it was going to be. Tommy went a day early to work on the heads with Jan, so he could show them like the heads to the tunes. And when I got there, we started playing the song and I started playing bass lines, and we kind of discussed things. And there was a couple of things where we did some linear things and worked those out, and then just counted it off and went for it. And Ken Scott was the engineer on it, who's one of the great engineers of things. So it was like a perfect little storm in there. Robert Moog came down. If you were listening to the album and you hear some little interludes where you hear stuff going, it's like electronic drums. Well, Robert Moog, the synthesizer genius, came there and brought down his first prototype electronic drums. So that was Billy experimenting with that. So there was a lot of stuff going on. We were hardly eating. There was a place called Orange Julius here in the States that made these like orange drinks and strawberry drink. We pretty much for 2 days lived. There was a one down the street, and we just kept ordering buckets of this stuff and drinking it. That was about it. I think we only had one meal in the 2 days. We were just in the zone on this. But that's the way it works best. When you really get into that headspace and you are there, you could be working for 5 minutes or 5 hours and it feels the same. You know, your brain is in another place. And that was a special project that I still feel incredibly fortunate to have had the opportunity to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously you've worked with so many drummers over the course of your career. Where does Billy Cobham rank amongst those that you've played with?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things where I've been really luckiest. Because I got to work with Billy Cobham. And one of the greatest drummers I ever worked with is Phil Collins. And I spent years with Phil. And then you have the Vinnie Colaiutas and the Greg Bissonettes. I've spent 54 years with Russ Kunkel. You know, and Jim Keltners and Jim Gordons. So when I look back at my career, probably one of the things I cherish the most is my relationship with some of the greatest drummers in the world. Yeah. I've gotten to work with Dave Weckl and Simon Phillips and all these guys. Yeah. So, you know, I every time I walk in a studio, I just sort of pinch myself and I just go, oh man, check out. And then the really exciting thing is if I end up working with a drummer I've never heard of, you know, a new guy on the scene, and you sit down and start playing and you go, oh, this is so good. You know, because each one brings like new nuances to your playing. Like one guy maybe leans on top of the beat where another guy sits behind the beat, another guy's right in the pocket, or somebody who like their snare is in front but their kick is in back. So you're constantly adjusting to this, and I don't look at it as a challenge. I look at it as just something that's really keeps me on my toes, keeps me thinking in different ways. Because you really, to do the job that I've done in this business, you really have to be a chameleon.
Yeah.
And you have to readjust what you do every day. You can't come in and say, well, this is what I do. You know, you're adjusting to different artists, different players and stuff. And I think that's the thing that's kept it fresh for me, is that you can't get complacent when you're in this end of the business, because you're challenged every day with something new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just going to say as well, because it attests to your brilliance in a way that rhythm sections are so important to any song. And the fact that you can work with so many different guys of different abilities and different styles, and as you said, in front of the groove and on the pocket and behind the beat and things like that. And the fact that you still pull off some incredible music is just fantastic.
Yeah, I love it every day. I still enjoy it as much today as I did when I first started working in the studio in 1970.
Fantastic stuff. Excellent choice for number one then. So what else are we going to have? What's going to be number two then, Leland?
I'm trying to think. One of the things, and it just got a kind of a rebirth, was Jackson Browne's first album, which had the song Doctor My Eyes on it, where I think all the songs, Jackson is one of the finest songwriters I've ever worked with. But Doctor My Eyes caught people for some reason. It was his most successful single. And, if I pull up YouTube, I see so many people doing, showing, their version of the bass line. But there was there's a thing called Playing for Change that they take a song and record it. And then they go around the world and have artists from all over the world contribute to it. And they just did that with Doctor My Eyes. We were in the studio working on The Immediate Family. And Jackson came by and he said, they've asked me to do this. And he got myself and Russ, we both played on the original Doctor My Eyes. We sat down in the studio and recreated it. I actually had the bass I used on the original, Russ had the Kunga drums that he played on the original. Because when we recorded that song originally, Russ played Kungas and then overdubbed the drum track afterwards. But the basic track was cut with Kungas. And then the great Jesse Ed Davis, one of the great guitar players of the day, who's no longer with us, came in and put a guitar solo on it. So all of a sudden it hit and it's had like millions of views on YouTube and stuff. So suddenly Doctor My Eyes got a new life going again. But I loved working with Jackson, and that was our first experience together, was that first album. And it's a relationship I've had as long as I've had with the guys. And we did Running on Empty with Jackson, and which is still one of the greatest live albums. So I would think that would be my second on that.
That's incredible. And just a quick talk on the bass. You said you had the original. I mean, that's 1972. That's we probably recorded in 1971. In fact, so over 50 years you've had that bass. Do you have many basses from all the way back in time?
No, that's really. Well, that's kind of the oldest one I have. And I had that since the 60s. And it was a 62 jazz bass. And one night while I was in college, I got bored and I took out a knife and a saw and carved the body all up and everything on it, which was a mistake. But at the time, it felt right. But I still use that bass. It's great. And then right next to me, sitting here, is it's known as Frankenstein. This is the bass that we built in like 73. And it's just covered in signatures and stuff, and it was it was never a real bass. It was it's a Charvel body. Charvel was a company making replacement parts, and a 62 Precision neck that we made into a jazz neck, and it has the very first EMG pickups, the very first hip shot detuner. So it was that's been my workhorse all the years. And then I also am involved with Dingwall for a five string, and Warwick for acoustics. So I'm not a collector. I have the basses that are important to me that I need for my job, but I'm not like a John Entwistle who had like 600 basses, have them hanging all over the walls and everything. That's not my thing, even though I was fortunate enough to sell John one of my basses that he wanted. So it was okay.
That is very cool. And that bass that you just showed us, thank you very much for showing us. I'm sure that's got a lot of stories it could tell as well. Incredible stuff.
Incredible stuff with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Jackson Browne. We've had Billy Cobham. So who else are we going to hear from?
Well, we have to start, we say James Taylor, because James was really right at the beginning for all of us coming together. And one of the songs that usually people cite that they love from James's catalog is Your Smiling Face, and that they love the bass part on that. I have bass players write to me all the time going, that's one of their all-time favorite parts. And with James again, it was really an organic thing. He would just come in and play guitar. He wouldn't tell us what to play on any of his songs. He would just sit down and play guitar. And for me, he was a challenge because his guitar's technique is one of the most comprehensive of any artist I've ever worked with, where so many guys just sit there and strum their guitar. He's got a finger picking thing where his thumb is constantly playing bass lines. And so when I started working with him, it was a challenge to figure out what to do, because he was kind of already playing bass on songs. So there were songs where I would double up what he was doing, but it also made me think in a different way, where I would start to think counterpuntally to him. So, well, here's where his bass is going. So let me swim around that a little bit. And it ended up with me creating a style that really worked on so many things that was really, up to that point, not something most people were doing. But I was really looking at people like McCartney and stuff as influences. And he still, some of the greatest bass lines ever were on Beatles songs McCartney did. So, but I would cite James Taylor definitely in there.
Absolutely. And James, obviously you worked with us for many years as well. I mean, when did you first meet James then? When did your paths first cross?
Well, our paths first crossed. I was in a band in the very late 60s called Wolfgang. And that was the band I was in when I met Tommy Bolin. And our drummer, Bugs Pemberton, was actually, he was a member of Jackie Lomax and the Undertakers in London back in the 60s. And they were kind of a rival to the Beatles at that time. And Bugs moved to Los Angeles. And we all came together and formed this band. But Bugs had a friend named John Fishbeck, who owned a studio called Crystal Recorders in Hollywood. And John had engineered and produced like all the early Stevie Wonder stuff, Songs in the Key of Life and that. And he used to come and hang out at our rehearsals with us. And a friend of his had just gotten back from England that he had known for years. And he brought him to our rehearsal, and it was James. And so I met James at a Wolfgang rehearsal, and he played us some of his songs and hung out. And we were going, oh, this guy's great. Well, when that he had just finished recording Sweet Baby James, and Peter Asher wanted to have the band that did the recording do the Troubadour show, which was going to really present James to the world at that point, but they didn't have a bass player. It was kind of a mishmash on the album as far as bass went. Okay. And James called Peter, and Peter was managing and producing him, and Peter was half of Peter and Gordon from the English invasion days. And he called Peter and he said, I found my bass player. And they tracked me down and asked me if I would play that show with them at the Troubadour. And I said, yeah, I was still in college at that point. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. Are you kidding? I figured it was one show, and it's so far I'm sort of still on the gig 54 years later. But that's how we connected, was through that band. That's, you know, that's why I always tell people, I said, if you can't never say no, if you get a call for something, some guys will go, oh, that's it's beneath me or whatever. You never know who you might meet at a thing. It might not be great music, but you might meet another person there that could change your life, which is what happened to me. So
absolutely,
avail yourself.
Yep. Great words of advice for anybody. Absolutely. And if you feel you can't do it, then I always say yes and then work out how to do it later. That's the other way of doing it too. Definitely.
Oh, I remember one of the great drummers of the 60s, Hal Blaine, who was like the main drummer in the Wrecking Crew. We were talking one day because I worked with him a great deal. And he said when he was first getting started, a producer called him and asked if he played percussion. And he said, oh, absolutely. He had never played percussion before. And then he immediately went out and bought some tambourines and shakers and sat around figuring them all out. Because he said, if I say no, they'll get somebody else in.
Yeah.
You know, so... You know, I mean, if it's something really out of your realm, then, you know, you can also say, you know, I would love to work with you, but I really, that's not my area of expertise. So you might want to call somebody else. But if there's ever something else, I would love, you know, and you don't just say no, you know, there's ways of working it where you can come out of it still okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant stuff. So that's James Taylor added to the list. Let's move on to your fourth choice then.
Well, one of the albums I worked on that I really became a cult album, it was really an interesting project. There was a guy named Gene Clark, and Gene Clark was the singer in the Byrds. He was in different combinations, like with Chris Hillman and Richie Furay and all these guys. But he was a great, great singer-songwriter. But eventually he left the Byrds, and he got a deal, and we went in the studio to do an album called No Other. And it wasn't successful commercially, but over the years, it's become incredibly underground successful. And I remember when we cut the title track for that, No Other, I think I have five basses on that track. I did subharmonic bass, played the melodic stuff on the track, fuzz bass, all kinds of stuff. They just kind of said, go for it. And I just sat there coming up with all kinds of ideas. So that was one of those unusual moments when there's been a few times where artists have said, just orchestrate it with the bass. Let's do that. Phil did that for on one of his tracks on No Jacket Required too. But my real memory of that project, we cut it at Village Recorders here in Los Angeles. And Joe Cocker was in the next studio working on an album. And we're in there. And I loved No Other, but it was a very hard record to make because things weren't formulated. So we were working over and over on tracks and really flogging really hard on this thing. The end result was great, but it was a hard album to make. And one of the tracks we were cutting, and it's one of those things, you know, when it's the right one, everybody's playing, but they're kind of looking at each other, kind of going, yes, you know, it's like the third day of it or something like that. And while we were recording, Cocker came in from the next studio and into the control room, and he'd been imbibing. He'd had something to drink, I believe. And he's sitting behind the desk and getting into it from what the engineers told me. And we're playing out there, and we're in the moment. And all of a sudden, he's so into it that he reaches down, hits the talkback button, and lets out one of those infamous Joe Cocker screams right into the microphone. Blew all our headphones off our heads. It was so loud. Gene was a big, tough dude. Gene knocked over the vocal booth to get in and get Joe because he was going to kill him. And Joe's people are dragging him down the hall to lock him back in his studio again. And we listened back to the tape because we're recording on tape still at that time. And you're listening, and it's as though somebody took a razor blade and cut the tape. That's how quickly everybody stopped. And we had to call the session. Everybody's ears were ringing, and we couldn't hear anymore. But I'll never forget that moment. And then watching Gene come out of that vocal booth to kill Cocker. And then I had the great fortune of working with Cocker later after he was all clean and everything. And it was a fat, because he was always one of my favorite artists. So it was really great to do a great album with the guy and hang out with him in the studio. So we went from this one extreme to the other.
Fascinating stories. I love hearing these stories from back in the day. They're brilliant. But it's an interesting choice of record. As you said, it's become a cult favorite, hasn't it? Because when it was released, it went down really negatively, let's be honest, with the critics. And I think the label pretty much refused to promote it. It cost a lot of money. Yeah. It lost a lot of money, but it did come back, as you said, a few years later, and it got re-released. And how did you feel at the time, though, when you put so much energy into it? And as you said, it was a difficult album to make, for it to just kind of flop the way it did.
I promise you, there are so many albums I've worked on that had the same fate. I mean, it's interesting. You'll go in the studio and you'll cut something and you'll go, this sucks. This is just horrible. Next thing you know, it's a number one record and it's on the air. And you'll go in and cut something else that you think is the best thing you ever worked on, and it doesn't even get released. Oh, wow. So when you're talking music and music business, there's a chasm between the two. So I don't really, I don't take any of that kind of stuff personally. I was really proud of No Other, and I think it's a great record, and it really shows Gene at his best. But, you know, for the fact that the label, you know, because sometimes you'll work on a project for a label that the label is so excited that you're doing, and just before the album gets finished and released, there's a change of administration at the label, and the new people that come in don't want anything to do with all the stuff they've been doing. They want their, you know, fingerprint on it, and they'll can the record at that point or not promote it. And you'll just sit there and you go, it's sad, but it's great that through, especially now through so many different platforms like YouTube and all that, stuff can be rediscovered and ends up taking on a whole new life. And No Other has been one of those things that if you were looking at the old famous tortoise and the hare race, well, it's the tortoise. You know, some people have a thing that goes boom, it's great, and bam, it's gone. Other things just sit there and they just cruise along decade after decade. And, you know, there's something great about that, because that having that longevity allows other generations to discover things. Where, I mean, to me, one of the most thrilling things is when I end up talking like friends of mine's kids or grandchildren, and they start talking, oh, God, Hendrix, man. You know, you're going, wow, this is a trip, you know. Yeah. So it's pretty great. But I don't judge things by their commercial success. Because that really that's out of my hands completely. All I can do is go in and try to make the best record we can. And then whatever happens after that, you know,
absolutely.
We can't control that.
That's right, indeed. And that's four. The fifth choice then is one you've already mentioned, and you talk about commercial success. It doesn't get much bigger than this next record. So what's the fifth choice?
What are you thinking it is?
Well, the list that you sent me included Phil Collins' No Jacket Required.
Okay, well, that's what I was going to say. Phil had called. I met Phil Collins' work in like 1980 or 81. We played on a track on a Lee Ritenour album. And he was aware of me because of James and Jackson and all that. And I was familiar with him through Genesis. So we hit it off immediately. There was kind of a mutual admiration and respect for each other. And he called me in 1981 after he had recorded Face Value and asked me to tour with him. And I said, man, I would love to do this, but I'm already committed to a James Taylor tour at that point. There was that was my primary artist because I was with James for 20 years. But I said, if it comes up again, I would love to talk to you. I'd love to do. And he called me in 84 and asked me if I could come to England and do his new album, which was No Jacket Required. And we did that at Townhouse Studios in Shepherd's Bush. And the thing that was interesting for me on that was I flew over there and he put me up in the Royal Garden Hotel in Kensington. And on the first morning, I get in the elevator and I got my gig bag with me, and we go down one floor and a guy gets in the elevator carrying a gig bag, and we still look at each other. And I said, he's a guitar player. And I said, what are you up to? We just had a casual conversation. He goes, I'm recording with Phil Collins. And I said, well, so am I. And it was Daryl Sturmer. And it was the first time we ever met. And I said, so where are you from? And he goes, Milwaukee. I said, me too. I was from Milwaukee. I mean, it was all these things. By the time we got to the ground floor, we were like best friends. And the studio was maybe a couple of, as you would say over there, a couple of kilometers away from where we were staying. And so every day we walked to the studio. And that was my first real experience recording with Phil. And it was just one of those things that it felt so good. And he's so musical and so talented that I loved every moment of it. But there's one song in there, like I was saying about the Gene Clark thing. I think it's Long, Long Way to Go, where I've got, I think, three or four basses on it. It's pretty much all bass, a sequence percussion part. And Daryl did some colors on it. And then Sting came in and sang harmony with Phil. But that album to me was just one of those ones that so stands the test of time. I mean, I can sit and listen to it today and it's, you know, what, 40 years ago we did that. And it still feels fresh, you know. But you know, that's probably one of the only heartbreaks I feel at this point is that Phil is not going to be working anymore. Because Phil was probably one of the most gifted, talented artist I've ever worked with. And I loved it. I mean, I love him as a friend and stuff, but he's had so many health issues and stuff. It's been difficult, but it was remarkable a couple of years back when we did the Not Dead Yet tour. And he's, you know, he can't play drums anymore because he had back surgery that screwed up the nerves to his hands and all this crap. And he has a condition called drop foot. where he really can't feel his right leg, so he has to walk with a cane just to, you know, he can walk, but it's not as stable as he needs to be. Could fall, and so he sits. He was sitting on a stool for the whole show, and I think there was concern, would people accept him? And we were out there playing 80,000 seat, you know, stadiums, and the people were going crazy for him because they wanted to be in his presence and they wanted to hear those songs. And he did a very credible performance in there. And what it enabled on that tour that was really great was it brought his son Nicholas to the forefront. And I'd known Nick since he was born. And when he was 4 years old, he was a really good drummer. And he's one of the better drummers I know at this point. And it's interesting, he's got a band called The Effect right now with Trevor Lukather, Steve Lukather.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, and they're great. They're really a good band. But Nick gets better all the time. After that tour, he went out with Mike and the Mechanics and did that. He went out with Genesis. And he was still a teenager doing all that stuff and killing it. And he's also one of the nicest people I know. It's not like he's this guy, he got the gig because his dad is so-and-so, you know, and he's an arrogant little shit and all that. he's really hungry to improve. He's as good a man as you'd want to know. So that was great. I love Phil and I love everything. I love the But Serious stuff and like the live concerts from Berlin that they showed and all the Not Dead Yet tour and the first Final Fair. All that stuff with Phil is some of my greatest memories.
Yeah, I was going to say that you can hear the affection that you've got for him in your voice. And at the end of the Immediate Family, the movie, I mean, there's that touching emotional scene where the two of you do get it really emotionally, get choked up, don't you, when you share an embrace and stuff. And it's so lovely.
And that was the day of our last show. That was the last show we played ever, was that day. And so we were all, nerves were really, you know.
Yeah.
So. I every time that I watch the film, when it comes to that, I choke up on it because I love the guy so much. And knowing that he's hurting and you know, and has had to call it quits, breaks my heart, because I would wish he could go out for another 5 or 10 years. You know, all of the band. And it's interesting, I'm touring now with an artist named Lyle Lovett and Lamont Van Hook and Amy Keys from Phil's band are now singing with Lyle. So we get to still have some road time together, which is pretty great.
Fantastic stuff. And just one last question about that. You've spoken about not knowing about the commercial success and that sort of thing is beside you. You're just focused on making the best record you can. But in terms of No Jacket Required, it was number one all over the world. It was diamond certified in the US for 12 times platinum, 6 times platinum in the UK, 3 Grammys, I think it won, something daft like that. It was a phenomenon. Is that the biggest album, biggest selling album that you've worked on?
Maybe. You know, maybe it's hard to tell because I never really follow up on that point, you know, because there's been so many that, you know, but he was a global artist. I know like the James Taylor's greatest hits album is, I don't know, it's been like 20 million units or something. I mean, it's really staggering the amounts that all these are. And then I've worked on things in other genres that are like huge in that genre. But you know, since I don't get points or anything on those, I really don't think about them because I'm not benefiting from all those sales. That's not the seat that we sit in. But I sit more in a seat of pride that we got to make these great records. And it was amazing. I mean, when we started the tour to promote No Jacket Required, it hadn't really hit yet. And we were playing small venues because he was, you know, he was just this drummer who was in a band kind of thing. And all of a sudden, like Sussudio hit the charts. And so, and all of a sudden we were canceling gigs and moving into arenas. And so, I mean, it happened so fast with him. And it was a remarkable little journey that we all found ourselves on. It was kind of like a musical tsunami that we got swept up in. But, that was, yeah, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing something from that album. He really did. And in becoming this incredible artist overnight, especially the British press just treated him like shit. All the reviews were terrible. They would be really kind of demeaning to him, saying, "Oh, it's the Cabbage Patch Kid of rock," and all that. And he took so much of that to heart. And it was really sad to watch because I'm going, we just played for 20,000 people. They went crazy. And the reviewer said, you suck. And you think the show sucked because of that. But the press was always really unkind to Phil. And he's one of the greatest artists of the generation. So it's a weird business. You know, there's aspects of it that are really horrible. And there's aspects that are absolutely the best thing in the world. So you have to just kind of go with it and put everything in proper perspective on it. It's hurtful when somebody says something negative about you, but you really have to look at the big picture and realizing you can sell out stadiums around the world. You know, it's like all the people that are dumping on Taylor Swift here in the press and stuff, yet she's out there doing more business than anybody's ever done. And her generosity is incredibly, it's unbelievable what she's accomplishing. So you just kind of go, well, screw these, the naysayers out there. What you're doing is obviously impacting people's lives in a positive way. So go for it.
Absolutely. And you've impacted so many people's lives in a positive way with all the music you've worked on. Leland, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you for the last 45 minutes or so and hearing your lovely stories about these incredible records as well. So thank you so much for your time here on VRP Rocks.
It's my pleasure. And if you ever want to do a part two, I'm here for you.
Absolutely. That sounds great.
There you go, Leland Sklar there. Make sure to check out VRP Rocks Radio, link in the description to this podcast. Give it a try, you won't regret it. Subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app. Check out VRP Rocks on YouTube and on all the social media channels too. But that's it until next week's episode. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.